You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 23rd of October, 2012, on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Nancy Durham. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, Kuwait, we ask, what future the monarchy? There's peace in Kosovo, so why were clouds of tear gas in the streets of Pristina yesterday?
It's very difficult to unravel what's going on here. And we're still in a position where most of the world doesn't recognise Kosovo's independence, although most of the EU does.
France looks at sending drones to Mali to quell the Al-Qaeda-inspired insurgency there. And we find out where Monocle's Adrian Craddock has been sent to.
I was one of those, maybe you might say, stranger kids who used to spend a lot of time in kind of stationery shops. I used to love, like, obsessing over the pens and, like, rulers and office furniture and stuff like that. I'm in heaven at the moment because I'm at the mother of all things like that. It's called Orgatech.
More of that later. So lots to come and some music too in the next hour here on Midori House. But first, let's catch up on the headlines with Bill Bingham.
Monocle 24 News. The head of Italy's disaster body, Luciano Maiani, has resigned in protest at prison sentences passed on seven colleagues over the 2009 earthquake in L'Aquila. Six scientists and an ex-official were convicted of multiple manslaughter for giving a falsely reassuring statement. Professor Maiani, who is a physicist, says the Serious Risk Commission could not work in such difficult conditions. The 6.3 magnitude tremor killed 3,009 people and left the city in ruins. US President Barack Obama has energetically taken on his Republican challenger Mitt Romney in their third and final presidential debate. During brisk exchanges in Florida, the rivals argued over the Arab Spring, Iran, Israel, and China. Two instant polls said Mr. Obama won the head-to-head. In Gaza, there's been a mixed reaction to the visit today of the Emir of Qatar, now the main sponsor of Hamas. Sheikh Hamad bin Khalifa Al Thani is the first head of state to visit since Hamas came to power in Gaza in 2007, as well as the first Arab leader to be there in person since 1967. Israeli Foreign Ministry spokesman Yigal Palmor was surprised that Qatar had taken sides.
No one understands why he would fund an organization which has become notorious with committing suicide bombings and firing rockets on civilians. By hugging Hamas, the Emir of Qatar is really someone who has thrown peace under the bus.
The Lebanese army has been deployed on the streets of Beirut and Tripoli in order to calm deadly tensions. Several people were killed in gunfights between pro and anti-Syrian factions in Tripoli on Monday after the death of a senior security official on Friday. EU foreign policy chief Catherine Ashton has called on Lebanon's political leaders to work on resolving their political divisions through dialogue. Britain's Foreign Secretary William Hague has been addressing a conference in Berlin on Britain's future relationship with Europe. He's told delegates Britain is more disillusioned than ever with the European Union and set out a vision of its future based on the premise less is more. That policy clashes head-on with Berlin's plans for the Eurozone. Mr. Hague dashed any hope of a conciliatory message to its European partner, which fears Britain is gradually withdrawing from the EU.
The coalition government in the United Kingdom is committed to Britain playing a leading role in the EU. But I must also be frank, public disillusionment with the EU in our country is the deepest that it has ever been. People feel that in too many ways the EU is something that is done to them, not something over which they have a say.
Italy's foreign minister has made the first formal visit to Somalia's capital, Mogadishu, by a top official from Rome for several decades. Giulio Terzi was welcomed by Somalia's newly elected president Hassan Sheikh Mohamud, who told him he was looking forward to a renewed cooperation between his country and their former colonial masters. Mr. Terzi's visit is a sign of improved security and confidence since Africa Union troops drove Islamic insurgents out of the capital and other cities which were previously under their control. Mr. Terzi said Italy will offer help in several areas.
the opportunity to assure the President of the strong commitment of the Italian government, of all the Italian institutions, in increasing areas of cooperation which go from economic development, the legal system, judiciary, and also cooperation among security apparatus, defense.
Authorities in St. Petersburg say they're investigating who produced an advice leaflet for migrants which has been called offensive. The leaflet, used by city authorities and printed by a private organisation, depicts migrants as cartoon paintbrushes and brooms. Officials from Tajikistan's foreign ministry have described it as insulting. Thousands of migrants from Central Asia live in Russia's big cities, many carrying out manual work. Some of the world's best-known artists are in Tokyo to receive the prestigious Premium Imperiale Award, the top Japanese Nobel Prize of Arts. The Japan Art Association is honouring five people: Chinese painter Xiao Guo Qiang, Italian sculptor Cecco Buonanotte, Danish architect Henning Larsen, American composer Philip Glass, and the Japanese ballerina Yoko Morishita. The prizes are worth 15 million yen each. That's around $188,000. And that's the news here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Bill. Bill Bingham. And it is just coming up to 7 minutes past the hour. You are listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. And here at Midori House, we're live and we're coming from Studio One in London. I'm Nancy Durham. The political turmoil in Kuwait continues with a standoff between the ruling emir and the elected opposition. Protesters vow to continue their demonstrations, even though they have been put down violently. They say they're not against the royal family, merely its, quote, unconstitutional practices. Jane Kinnamont is Senior Research Fellow at the Chatham House Middle East and North Africa Program. Good evening.
Good evening.
You've been writing about Middle Eastern monarchies and the perception that they are somehow resilient, more resilient than the neighboring leadership in republics. How resilient is Kuwait's monarchy?
Well, Kuwait may have a better chance than some others in that it does have pressure valves. It does have a parliament. It's got a tradition of limiting the power of the emir. And what has really contributed to this recent escalation has been a unilateral decision by the emir to change the voting system in order to prevent the opposition from having a parliamentary majority. And many Kuwaitis are quite angry about that.
Why is he doing that at this delicate moment when such moves are you know, not winning any votes around the entire region?
Well, the political crisis in Kuwait has its roots a bit further back than the Arab uprisings. For some years now, there have been confrontations between the parliament and the government, and the default way of solving them has been actually not to solve them, but to dissolve the parliament and call fresh elections. And this has been happening time and time again. The most recent elections were held in February this year, and then as early as this summer, the parliament was dissolved once again. So frustration has been rising, you know, both for voters and for the government. Something has to give. There needs to be some kind of serious reform. The opposition has been calling for the government to give up much more power, and the government, meanwhile, seems to be trying to assert itself.
So does the monarchy, in fact, really have to give something in order to survive? Is it coming that close to the wire?
They evidently think that they can see this through by changing the electoral system. But Kuwait has a very long tradition of keeping the rulers in check, and I think it's unlikely to succeed. That said, one of the things you also have to look at is how united the opposition can remain. And some parts of the opposition have started really to criticise the emir very personally, to say, we will not allow you to do this. You do not have our permission. For others in the opposition, that's going frighteningly too far.
So how is this playing out as we speak? I mean, more demonstrations are on the agenda.
They are. And what's really fascinating is that this is being watched right across the Gulf. I mean, with the uprising in Bahrain, initially we saw people in the other Gulf countries sympathising with the protesters to some extent when they saw civilian protesters being shot down in the streets. But over time, the sympathy with the Bahrainis was curtailed essentially by the use of sectarian politics that many Sunni Muslims who make up the majority of people in the Gulf were constantly being told these are just sectarian protests, it's only Shia protesting, it has nothing to do with you, they're following an Iranian agenda and so forth. In Kuwait, in a way, the stakes are higher because it's not as easy to use the sectarian cards. There will be attempts to discredit the protesters by saying that they are too Islamist. But of course, there will be many across the Gulf who sympathise with that.
Let me take you, if not away, but over to the sort of general look that you've been taking on monarchies in Middle Eastern monarchies. And you've written about how it is easier for them to change, to give up a little power, but still maintain something. Can you tell me what you mean by that?
Well, I think they have more options to reform, but I don't think that their survival is inevitable. I think it's far from assured. I simply think that there are models for monarchs to cede some of their power while also retaining some power, some dignity, wealth, status, and so on. And we've seen this across most of Europe over the past 100 years. However, I think many of the monarchs are doing little to reform. I mean, we see interesting cases in Jordan, in Morocco, and to some extent in Oman, where rulers have responded to protests by promising political reforms and by agreeing to open up some more political space for debates. But not all the monarchies have reacted in this way. One might argue that the rest of them have, if anything, become more repressive, and that's simply not working. Creating more political prisoners, creating more martyrs, really seems to be something that is now backfiring for a younger generation in the Arab world.
So at the risk of sounding like I'm asking the same question again, I'm trying to get a sense from you of whether the Kuwait monarchy is like absolutely going to have to change in order to survive. I wasn't sure if you mentioned it wasn't going to work, whether you were talking about the opposition or about the monarchy.
I think that the strategy that the rulers have been deploying for the past couple of years of dissolving the parliament every time there's a clash with the parliament is simply unsustainable and is greatly damaging the country's economy. MPs may share some blame in this, but I think the latest effort to unilaterally change the constitution was bound to backfire in Kuwait because it is, of all the Gulf monarchies, the one that seems to have the greatest pride in having something approaching a constitutional monarchy. They have a very strong tradition of this, and I think it's fairly predictable that this move would anger people and radicalise them.
So with the feistiness of the opposition, we're bound to see many more clashes like the ones we've seen recently.
I think it's likely. I think it's one of the things that is the most fascinating about the case of Kuwait is that this is by far the wealthiest Arab country to see protests, and it really belies the oft-held assumption that Gulf countries will be able to escape political change simply because they're rich. What you see now is a generation of younger, educated and angrier Kuwaitis who are, at least in some cases, happy to face tear gas, who were at the protest shouting, you know, we don't fear your batons anymore. There has been a step change in expectations compared to their parents' generation, who still really held the rulers responsible for the oil development of the 1970s and were perhaps more grateful for the economic development they'd experienced in their lifetime.
Thank you very much for this. Jane Kinnamount is Senior Research Fellow at the Chatham House Middle East and North Africa Program.
Wherever you're going this autumn, and whether it's for work or play, let Monocle's editors be your travel companions. We've just refreshed and revised our team's guides to the world's top business cities and resorts, so you can have our 25-25 travel guide series in the palm of your hand with the Monocle app available from iTunes or download free guides from monocle.com. From São Paulo to New York, Capri to St. Bart's, we can show you where to long lunch or go for your morning run. Just go to the iTunes App Store and download the Monocle app. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
London, Tokyo, Hong Kong, New York, and Toronto. On October the 19th, Monocle opened the doors to its newest shop. Chock full of our regular goodies from Porter bags, Ettinger leather goods, 2013 Diaries by Marks, and Hakisan ceramic wine cups. Check out all of our collaboration products or flip through the latest issues of the magazine. Find the perfect gifts for Christmas or just a treat for yourself. Visit us on College Street in Toronto or at our other shops around the world. And remember, you can sign up to our weekly bulletin at monocle.com to find out about all of the newest products as they hit the shelves.
You're listening to Midori House. France has al-Qaeda-backed rebels in Mali in its sights. The country is apparently planning to send drones to the West African country in an attempt to put down the growing insurgency there. The Associated Press says France is in secret talks with the United States over the planned mission. European Union leaders on Friday said the rebels pose an immediate threat to Europe. Well, joining us on the line now is Monocle's South African correspondent, Alex Duval-Smith. Hello.
Hello.
Alex, could you take us back just a little to March, I think it was, when the trouble began?
Absolutely. Well, on the 21st of March, there was a coup in Bamako, the capital of Mali, when junior officers took over the government, essentially ousting a government they were unhappy with because it had not, in their view, given them the capacity to deal with a rebellion in the north, a rebellion led by Tuaregs, Tuaregs being the sort of desert nomads who, for centuries, have controlled the areas of the Sahel and the Sahara. Going back centuries, they were the people running the caravan routes, carrying salt to Egypt, and many of them have sort of diversified into banditry. And more importantly, they were bolstered in number because many Tuaregs returned from Libya after the conflict there, bringing arms with them to northern Mali and garnering in the process some support from Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb and other Islamist forces. So the Tuareg rebels were in control of the north of the country. They hadn't seceded at that time, and junior officers in Bamako, the capital, were unhappy with the way the government was dealing with it and took over power.
So there's a kind of a mixed bag of rebels then in the north, the Tuareg and some Islamist groups that aren't necessarily of the same stripe at all, but they're working together?
Yeah, well, they're working together and they're not working together. In fact, more recently, the Tuaregs have distanced themselves from the Islamists. The Islamists are divided into three groups most of the time. Mm. Just last week, actually, one of the Tuareg groups distanced itself and said that they didn't want to collaborate with the Islamists anymore. The Islamists have famously already destroyed some historic mosques and taken over Timbuktu, which is in Mali, and made themselves quite unpopular with the population. So the Tuaregs, of course, whose homeland it is, if you like, have found themselves quite uncomfortably allied with the Islamists. Now, I should add that it's very hard to measure the size of the Islamist forces. I mean, in the Western imagination, there's a tendency to think of northern Mali as a new Afghanistan where, you know, behind the sand dunes, terrorists are going to be trained, etc.
Not so.
They are. They have supported the Tuaregs, but the Tuaregs are really the people in charge of northern Mali.
So this talk of France sending in the drones with secret talks of the U.S., with Europe saying, you know, there's an immediate threat here. What would these drones be sent in to do?
Well, they would be. France has accelerated its withdrawal from the NATO alliance in Afghanistan, so they would be brought at the end of this year from Afghanistan. France doesn't have armed drones, it only has surveillance drones, so that's what they would be there to do, to watch. And I think it's important to look at actually what is being said and the subtext of what's being said. There's so much military sort of talk and saber rattling going on in the last few days that one sort of has visions of European troops and American troops deploying in Mali, and that's really not at all likely. The Europeans and Americans will, at best, I think, provide some military advisors and certainly provide logistics and surveillance.
And Alex, last question, if I may, what has the reaction been in Mali to the news of these drones?
Well, I mean, that's the problem in Mali. Mali is now currently run by a government which is transitional, which has civilians in it, but still is strongly dominated by the military, who haven't left power by any stretch of the imagination. But their junior officers, they will look, I think, they will take a jaded view of foreign military intervention on their territory. ECOWAS, the West African force being proposed, coming in with foreign arms onto their territory. The Malian army is weak. The Malian army at the moment is even short of munitions. In fact, one big armaments delivery was stuck in the port of Conakry in Guinea for several months. So that just gives you an idea of how weak the Malian army is. And I think one very important factor which is being forgotten amid all these talks going on, both in Paris, in New York, and in Bamako itself, where the African Union has been meeting, is that if the fragile state of Mali, if the nation state of Mali can't function, if there isn't a government you can call anything by any stretch of imagination democratic, then there's no point in restoring peace to a country where the democracy is far from able to prevail.
Alex, thank you. That's Alex Duval-Smith, Monocle's South African correspondent. You are listening to Midori House with me, Nancy Durham. Indonesia has recorded another record-breaking quarter of foreign direct investment, up 22% year on year. Now, this looks like good news for Southeast Asia's biggest economy just when it needed it. Following some recent high-profile boardroom disputes, some analysts had suggested overseas investors may have been reluctant to pour resources into the country. So, what's the truth? Well, a little earlier, the editor-in-chief of Globe Asia, Indonesia's biggest business publication, Shoaib Kagda, spoke with our news editor, Tom Edwards.
So, Shoaib, I wanted to ask you, first of all, about this new figure that's reflecting a really significant jump in foreign direct investment. Just tell us what this means for the economy of Indonesia.
This year has been a great year for foreign direct investments. I think we're up 22%. It looks like it's going to be a record year for foreign direct investments. You know? The factors that are driving foreign direct investments are primarily, of course, a fast-expanding economy. The Indonesian economy is growing at 6.5% and is likely to grow at the same rate next year. So that attracts a lot of investors. Secondly, you know, there has been a revival in the manufacturing sector in the past 2 years, you know. After the 1997 Asian financial crisis, you know, Indonesia's industrial sector went through a challenging period. A lot of companies were leaving the country because of the political instability. But in the last 2 years, you know, political stability has been restored. But primarily, I think Indonesia is now seen as a competitive economy vis-a-vis China, where costs are rising very rapidly. We have what we would call a medium-skilled labor force. They're not highly skilled, but they're not very lowly skilled. So for a lot of manufacturing companies, for example, in the auto industry, auto spare parts, in the higher-end textile sector, I also, you know, L'Oreal, the French cosmetics manufacturer, last month announced the largest ever factory they built in Indonesia at a cost of about $200 million.
It's a very interesting picture, Shoaib. I just wondered, though, we still see occasionally some negative reports about the restrictions on foreign firms expanding into Indonesia. How much is that a factor in these figures, do you think?
You know, the government has established what it calls a negative list of industries where foreign companies are not allowed to invest. But these are basically what the government has classified as strategic industries. For example, in telecommunications, in media, you know, and then there are a number of other industries. Now, the big question mark at the moment is over the mining industry, because you know, mining has been one of the top performers in the last few years. But now the government has come down with new regulations which actually dissuade foreign investments into the mining industry. And this is primarily because they want companies to move downstream rather than just do pure mining and then export the minerals.
I wanted to ask you, Shoaib, about one particular example, obviously, that's made the press internationally, is this dispute between Nat Rothschild and the Bakri family over Bumi PLC. How damaging do you think that kind of coverage is? And do you think that perception, at least from overseas, risks affecting these otherwise very encouraging foreign investment figures?
I think there's been some damage in terms of investor perceptions, you know, doing business in Indonesia, especially with large politically connected families. You know, the Bakris, you know, I wouldn't say a very positive history, but they have a history of doing deals and walking away from deals, both Indonesia and around the region. This whole blow-up around Bumi PLC and now Nat Rothschild stepping down from the board and, you know, the Bakris looking to buy back. I think it opens investors to the dangers of getting in the wrong bed, you know, when doing business in Indonesia. You have to be careful.
And Shoaib, I wanted to ask you also about just the perceptions going forwards. Obviously, these figures are very robust. Is there any concern? We've seen, for example, the World Bank forecasting a slight restriction on growth into next year. Yeah. Is there a perception there that these kind of figures mean that the economy will be robust enough to cope with that kind of coverage?
I think the economy will be strong, but I think the greater question is about regulatory reforms in Indonesia. A lot of investors are really pushing the government to move faster on a number of reforms. Number one, of course, is creating a better investment climate. And it still takes too long, I think something like 56 days to register a business in the country, you know. There's still a lot of bureaucratic red tape when you want to get a license to do something. And investors, foreign investors, want those things to be streamlined, number one. Number two, you know, they need better clarity in terms of investing in the regions, because, you know, under regional autonomy law, a regional governor has more power than the president of Indonesia when it comes to his region or to his province. A lot of these regions have come up with very complicated and very confusing laws, which need to be cleaned up. That really is, I would call, you know, the major challenges facing Indonesia if it wants to maintain the strong, robust foreign direct investment flow, which it is enjoying at the moment.
That was Shoaib Kagda talking with Monocle's Tom Edwards a little earlier today. Well, it's a party day here today at Midori House at Monocle, and so this is a fitting song coming up from our live Midori House session earlier this year. This is James Yorkston with Border Song.
Something o'clock, the bird clock called, and I shivered and I shuddered, half awake, and my back was turned, but half asleep, I envisioned a rook, angry and ash shoot from coming down the chimney, anxious to peck at the eyes and to poke at the feet of the slumbering Scotsman and his confused partner. But our last snow and our last day was a gem, a frozen walk, a slip and a slide, and no rush to escape. Our morning spent, and no mention of north of the border, and our last day was a gem, a frozen walk, a slip and a slide, and a rush to escape. Our morning spent, no mention of north of the border. And drunk I had hidden your clothes, and you awoke first and fast and struggled to find them in this frozen room, hiding under the covers from this almost complete stranger. And when I awoke, I did not know where I was. A grey lit room, I could see my breath and your long dark head and your long thin back, and it took me all of 3 seconds to remember where we were, who you were, and why I was here. To remember where we were and who you were, and why I was here. To remember where we were and who you were, and why I was here. To remember where we were and who you were, and why I was here. What advice can I give to someone so young? Do not lead your life like mine. Do not lend your life to somebody like me. But you failed in the gaps and my shy started blues. They became more amusing in their absurdities. The less sense than making the more fun we're having. Do not care, for I do not care. We cannot afford to care, as this is nothing. Just a flirt, just a flicker, just a taster of what is not to come. This is nothing, just a flirt, just a flicker, just a taster of what is not to come. This is nothing, just a flirt, just a flicker, just a taster of what is not to come. This is nothing, just a flirt, just a flicker, just a taster of what is not to come. This is nothing, just a flirt, just a flicker, just a taster of what is not to come. This is nothing, just a flirt, just a flicker, just a taster of what is not to come.
And that applause was for James Yorkston and Border Song. In the next half hour of the program, we're going to be heading to the Cologne Office Furniture Fair, and we'll be joined in the studio by Monocle's editor-in-chief, Tyler Brûlé. But first, here's Bill Bingham with the news headlines.
The head of Italy's disaster body, Luciano Maiani, has resigned in protest at prison sentences passed on 7 colleagues over the 2009 earthquake in L'Aquila. 6 scientists and an ex-official were convicted of multiple manslaughter for giving a falsely reassuring statement. US President Barack Obama has been campaigning in Florida after energetically taking on his Republican challenger Mitt Romney in their third and final presidential debate. During brisk exchanges in Florida, the rivals argued over the Arab Spring, Iran, Israel and China. 2 instant polls said Mr. Obama won the head-to-head. In Gaza, there's been a mixed reaction to the visit today of the Emir of Qatar, now the main sponsor of Hamas. Sheikh Hamad bin Khalifa Al Thani is the first head of state to visit since Hamas came to power in Gaza in 2007, as well as the first Arab leader to be there in person since 1967. The Lebanese army has been deployed on the streets of Beirut and Tripoli in order to calm deadly tensions. Several people were killed in gunfights between pro and anti-Syrian factions in Tripoli on Monday after the death of a senior security official on Friday. Britain's Foreign Secretary William Hague has been addressing a conference in Berlin on Britain's future relationship with Europe. He's told delegates Britain is more disillusioned than ever with the European Union and set out a vision of its future based on the premise less is more. Italy's foreign minister has made the first formal visit to Somalia's capital, Mogadishu, by a top official from Rome for several decades. Giulio Terzi was welcomed by Somalia's newly elected president, Hassan Sheikh Mohamud, who told him he was looking forward to renewed cooperation between his country and their former colonial masters. And that's the news here on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Bill Bingham. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24, and we're coming to you live from London. There have been few worse neighbours in the world than Serbia and Kosovo. The former still considers the latter its spiritual heartland and resents its determination to win independence. Kosovars hate Serbs for decades of repression and, of course, the late 1990s war. Appeals to reason and compromise on either side of the border struggle for a receptive audience, as was demonstrated for the umpteenth time yesterday. A protest against improving ties, that's against improving ties between Serbia and Kosovo, was tear-gassed by Kosovo police. At least 20 people were injured and dozens arrested. Earlier today, Andrew Muller talked with our man in Belgrade, Guy Delaney.
Who was protesting and what were they upset about?
It was the self-determination movement in Kosovo, which was protesting. And they were upset, as you say, at the idea that relations might be improving between Kosovo and Serbia. And this is because of a meeting last Friday between the prime ministers of the two countries, Ivica Dacic of Serbia and Hashim Tači of Kosovo. And this is the first time that the prime ministers of Kosovo and Serbia have actually met, shaken hands, since Kosovo unilaterally declared independence in 2008. So in some ways, that was a little bit of history, and it indicated that things may be starting to get a little bit better. But this angered the self-determination movement, because they're saying it looks to them like a ruse by Serbia just to try and get its EU membership talks back on track.
Do the self-determination movement have a point? I know Albin Kurti, the leader of the self-determination party, slightly, and he's not a... He's not a crank. He's a generally fairly reasonable fellow. Does he have some sort of point here?
Well, I don't know, but the demonstration yesterday, from the footage that I've seen of it, I'm in Belgrade, not in Pristina, but it actually appears to have been fairly well ordered and to have involved members of parliament as well. It deteriorated after it had been going on for the best part of a day. There was a standoff between the two sides, and finally the police seemed to have lost patience and fired tear gas, which resulted in a few dozen injuries. I mean, the question is, you know, it's a big one, isn't it? The whole sort of tangled mess between Kosovo and Serbia, which you've got a very good insight on, better than most people would suggest, it's very difficult to unravel what's going on here. We're still in a position where most of the world doesn't recognise Kosovo's independence, although most of the EU does. This puts Serbia in an awkward position because it would dearly like EU membership. On the other hand, Kosovo's in this delicate position because while the EU's in favour of its independence, a lot of the world, including large near neighbours like Russia, are not. So nobody wants to feel like they're losing out, really.
What's the view of this from where you are in Belgrade? How do Serbs feel about Kosovo now? Are they resigned to the fact that it's gone, or is there still a determination or a desire to get it back?
You know, there was a survey that just came out yesterday, which was sponsored by the European Union, to look at what the attitudes were of people in Serbia towards the European Union. And there were a couple of interesting things that came out of it. One was that people are generally a bit more sceptical about the EU these days. I think only 48% now strongly in favour of joining. But another thing that came out of it was that most people within Serbia, when they're looking at their chances of being accepted for EU membership, right at the top of issues which they think need to be complied with is Kosovo. This is ahead of any economic considerations, any other human rights considerations. Right at the top of their list is Kosovo. So these issues are very, very closely tied together. And of course, you know, Serbia's seen a lot of its, you know, Belgrade was the capital of the Yugoslav Federation. It was a capital city designed for this great big area of the Western Balkans. Now it's the capital city of a rather smaller country of 7 million, which keeps getting snipped away at, and of course that has an impact on people's morale and the view of their own nation.
And what was the view in Belgrade of that extraordinary sight, really, of Serbia's prime minister shaking hands with the former KLA commander Hashim Thaci?
Again, as soon as that came out, we had President Nikolic, who wasn't at that meeting, saying that, well, we are not going to negotiate on Kosovo. We are not going to, there's a red line, he said. We're not going to pass that red line and discuss independence for Kosovo at all. So very quickly, we were seeing people saying, look, we've got this meeting. Relations might be improving. That doesn't mean we're about to make any major concessions, and certainly not independence.
That was Guy Delaney, Monocle's man in Belgrade. You're listening to Midori House, and we'll be right back after this.
The November issue of Monocle takes the pulse of the world as we investigate how good healthcare makes a nation. We reveal who has the best nurses, meet a mayor who put his city on a diet, and visit a hospital the size of a city. And there's lots more to make you feel better about the world, too.
In the business section, we find out about the healthy Japanese tipple that represents a $1.2 billion industry. We take to the skies with the CEO of Australia's Royal Flying Doctor Service, and our Washington correspondent profiles the small businesses making a healthy profit on the US presidential campaign trail.
In the affairs section, we go on the road with an elderly band of diplomats. I sit down with Malaysia's Mr. Fixit, and we also present our 10-point plan for the next US president, whoever that may be. In the design section, we tackle grey matters, looking at three pioneering projects designed for the elderly around the world. We also create our own perfect community in which to grow old. Elsewhere, we drop in on a beautiful new cancer treatment centre by Nord Architects in Copenhagen that's more like a home than a hospital.
The November issue of Monocle also includes a special expo that limbers up with Japanese companies as they bend knees and reach for better profits with the aid of morning exercise routines. It's all on newsstands now and also available via subscription at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
You are listening to Midori House, and the time is now 40 minutes past 1800 here in London. Now, one of our very favourite pastimes here at Monocle 24 is sending our intrepid young blade, Adrian Craddock, out on the road. So today we've dispatched him to Cologne to report on the latest goings-on at Orgatech, the glamorous trade fair for modern office equipment. A little earlier, our news editor, Tom Edwards, caught up with Adrian and asked him what makes the event so special.
So, Adrian, I know, you know, we love to send you out to all sorts of exciting places. I gather you've pitched up in Cologne today. Tell us what you're doing there.
Can I just start off with a little story? Because when I was younger, I was one of those, maybe you might say, stranger kids who spent a lot of time in kind of stationery shops. And I used to love, like, obsessing over the pens and, like, rulers and office furniture and stuff like that. Basically, I'm in heaven at the moment because I'm at the mother of all things like that. It's called Orgatech. It's basically the world's largest trade show of office furniture, which does sound, I'm going to admit it, it does sound a little bit dry, but it's really where kind of innovators in the field kind of gather together and kind of, it's very psychological. They're all talking about how to use design to create these atmospheres that are conducive to good work and kind of really creative working atmospheres. It's an interesting place.
But I just wondered, in the old traditional battle, one of the debates is open plan offices against the sort of, you know, cubicles, more tightly structured workspaces. What's the verdict there? Is there any kind of news on this ongoing discussion?
Yeah, it's quite interesting because, I mean, I came at this thinking that it was all going to be really kind of sleek, open plan offices on display. But the reality is, it's a bit of a move back to this kind of idea of privacy in the cubicle, maybe reinvented in a little way. One of the big exhibitors here today is Vitra, who are a Swiss office furniture manufacturer. They're really kind of leading the way in this industry. And they've kind of come out with this concept idea almost of these they call them cabins, and they're these structures which almost look like a cubicle, but they're in kind of these organic shapes. They're made out of really strange kind of felt feeling that it almost feels like grass. And it's all about, you know, there are spaces in the office where we want to kind of have these chance meetings. We want to be able to talk with colleagues. But they are banking on this idea that there's still this kind of almost very fundamental human instinct of wanting to have a place to retreat to, and they're kind of putting their chips in that corner.
That sounds really interesting. So is there generally quite a lot of optimism then about the modern office? You know, I guess sometimes at these sort of events you get the doom and gloom merchants who say, oh, it's all going to be different and hot desking and people aren't interested anymore. But it sounds like that's actively not the case, and it's still a thriving and creative environment.
Yeah, I think the focus here, or rather the kind of through line, is that the office will always really be relevant, even if it's a paperless office, even if, you know, people don't really need to store, you know, big books and binders. The main thing is people and the idea that people make a successful business. And if you think about it, that's really not going to change in the future. So office furniture and offices of the future are all about kind of creating these environments where people can kind of really interact with ease, can have a dynamic discussion, can kind of demonstrate ideas, articulate them, and that's really the kind of focus. The idea that, you know, everyone's on the internet at the moment, email and kind of mobile devices are making the office obsolete, is kind of being proved as a bit of a fallacy here. Everyone is pretty confident that offices will be, you know, a cornerstone of businesses well into the future.
Now, you mentioned the young, impressionable Adrian Craddock. I imagine a fairly chubby little kid, maybe doesn't have that many friends, consoling himself by looking at office furniture. I wonder, what does the new, lissom, cutting-edge, high-fashion Adrian Craddock of today make of the event? Did you have a favourite piece, for example?
Back in the day, I used to get pretty excited about, you know, a pretty standard piece of kit, whether it be, you know, my latest ballpoint pen or whatever. But at the moment, the thing that I'm really excited about is there was a Swiss company that I came across that basically they're doing, I can't even call them tables and I can't really call them chairs because they're the same thing. It's a singular piece of wood. It's a singular surface. And the chairs are kind of, the parts of the wood kind of dip in to make a kind of chair structure. So the entire surface is both the chair and the table at the same time. It's just this really kind of futuristic looking, but still kind of sleek and cool looking working surface that I don't know whether they'll catch on in the mainstream, but it looked pretty impressive. That's what kind of caught my eye today.
That sounds good. I just wonder, in terms of the ongoing trends, we've mentioned the traditional debate of open plan v cubicle. Are there any new fads that have struck you? Anything that we'll be looking out for to see in the offices, you know, in cities throughout the world in the next couple of years?
Yeah, it was kind of weird, actually, because obviously the Scandinavian countries really do kind of dominate in this kind of field. They really do push the envelope. And it seems like the big trend at the moment, at least in countries like Sweden and Denmark, is the idea of raised work surfaces. So a lot of the desks that they're using there have a facility where you can either lower it or bring it up to standing level. And a lot of people are actually kind of working while standing, or at least getting a chair that's almost like a stool, like a much, much higher chair. That might sound a bit kooky, it might sound like a bit of a fad, but the thinking behind it is, you know, if your colleague walks into the office or a superior or a client, immediately you're on eye level, immediately you can engage. It's a much more agile, dynamic way to work. And also, you know, just physiologically, we weren't born, you know, sitting down. We weren't born hunched over a desk. Just a more natural way to work, you know, standing up, or at least that's the argument.
That was Monocle's Adrian Craddock on assignment in Cologne, speaking with our news editor, Tom Edwards. And now a song I really like a lot. It's Coop Island Blues by Coop. Island Blues and Coop. I love that song. And Tyler Brulé, you introduced that song to me, I think when the magazine launched.
It could have been, yeah. How many years ago? Five and a half. Coming on 6 years.
Coming on six.
We had Coop perform. And what's interesting is tonight, we won't give away tonight away. But should you introduce me first? People may not know who I am.
Who are you? We've got a mystery guest here, our editor-in-chief. You've got how many? Is that the favorite title?
I prefer editor-in-chief.
Editor-in-chief. I like that, too.
I'm also a CEO. I'm also a chairman. CEO,
yeah. And so Chief Tyler Brulé is with us now. And it's great to see you because I haven't seen you for weeks and weeks. And you've been trailing across America. You've been in Dallas. I have to find out where you slept there because you checked out of your hotel.
I did. I lasted about 5 minutes in that hotel.
And then, like, 5 minutes later, you were in Lederhosen.
No, that was 5 days before.
5 days before. Okay, well, anyway. Who cares about continuity, right?
I'll show you pictures
later.
I
want photographic evidence. You sound absolutely adorable. A little goatee beard on your hat and leather.
It was goat beard. You're right.
But that's...
Some people thought it was feathers. They have to lock that onto your hat.
Lock it? Like with a...
Actually with a proper lock because people want to nick them.
No kidding. Like a padlock.
Like a little padlock. Mini padlock. Mini Bavarian lock.
I'm trying to segue from that padlock to... our 1 year anniversary.
Go for it.
You unleashed me and all of us. You unlocked this fabulous 24-hour radio station. And here we are. And in a way, I can't believe a year has gone by. And it's
here
fantastic
we are,
fun.
A year and 8 days later?
Yeah.
Yeah, amazing. The party would have been last week, but we were on the road. We were in Toronto.
And where the city of my birth.
Right.
And you opened a bureau, a shop.
We've opened a bureau, shop, offices for Wink Creative, our sister agency.
Fantastic.
776 College Street. Open every day till 7 except Sundays.
How terrific is that?
It is good.
Were and you embraced? People were
surprised because, you know, we've been quite critical of Toronto. And I think we are still a little bit critical of Toronto. Development run riot. Andrew Tuck, our editor, heard that there is more development going on in Toronto than anywhere else in the developed world. It depends on where you draw the line on developed, but
oh dear,
yeah, there is so much construction, Nancy. My mom said she wants to be in the cement business.
Oh, well, that could be another branch
well,
for you.
Because,
and we could probably use some of it around
here. Because my mom was in
charge
of doing the shop, so but we didn't. There was no cement involved, though.
Well, maybe you could, now that you've got a big foot in there, you could become the mayor someday.
Not a big foot from BC, not like a Sasquatch.
A tiny foot. A little Tyler Lederhosen-dressed
exactly.
foot in there on College Street.
Correct.
But how exciting. I think it's great.
Yeah, no, it is good.
And you'll
be
a voice.
We also have, aside from small feet, we also have a very small radio studio. Good enough for two people. We could do this segment there. But I'd practically be sitting on your lap.
Oh, well, okay.
Jump across the table.
we mustn't talk like that with the BBC inquiry going on.
I know.
Isn't that just amazing? We don't probably have time to explore that.
No, I don't think
we
do on
this
program.
But I've been riveted to that.
I have as well.
Yes.
But up to a point. It's interesting how that story then leaks across into the international edition. I'm not so sure how concerned people in Perth might be.
I've been interested and fascinated by the interrogation of George Entwistle and his difficulty in answering questions.
Particularly seen that.
This morning, he was grilled for hours
right.
and simply didn't know the answers to
poor
questions.
Poor thing. He just jumped into the director general's seat, and then he's landed with this. Not great. And there, of course, you have the former DG over in New York already with his feet up at the New York Times. Not quite. I'm sure his feet aren't up. One foot up.
Am I ever glad I'm out of here? Can you just imagine?
Am I ever glad I caught that last BA flight out of here?
I'd like to see the text messages that are going back and forth. Oh, dear.
No, I know.
But here we are. Can we say a little bit about the party?
Because Sure, of course.
We're going to have Monocle readers and listeners here this evening.
Yeah, hopefully everyone's a reader. Hopefully everyone's a listener. Last week we did an event, which was, we did two events in Toronto. One was for our partners and advertisers and collaborators. We also did an event on Saturday, which was for our readers. Tonight is mostly a thank you. It's not as big as we did last year, but it is a thank you to all of our collaborators, all of the guests who wake up at unearthly hours to come in and do the Globalist in the morning, and all of the people who've been, you know, our partners, suppliers, our advertisers. So it's very La Familia this evening.
Fantastic.
And we have a great, so just on the coupe segue, we have Celia Sandin. She's performing tonight. She, of course, performed on the original coupe album. So she's going to be singing for us. She's got a great ensemble outside this evening.
I heard little noises, lovely
little
noises coming from her earlier.
And there's tinkling of lots of glasses outside. I think the Krug is being poured right now. And it's going to be a good evening.
Fantastic.
And I think tonight it's a special night as well. We're going to be on air right up until midnight. So that means all of our segments all the way across the evening will be live tonight as well. Because sometimes we have some segments recorded in the evening.
People will be running in and out of here into
Correct.
The studio,
yes.
giving little interviews.
Exactly.
Anybody wandering around with a mic?
There might be someone on the go, but I think a lot of the technical equipment, there was actually a problem just as I was coming in the studio now, that there's so much power for all of the speakers and everything beyond these walls that they're having trouble plugging in the ovens for the canapes and dinner tonight.
Oh, so
that's
few little snags. That is a problem.
It is. We might have to run a cable over to our Emma Nelson's flat, which she's over the wall on the on the other side. So,
and my flat's not too far from here.
We could do that as well. I was coming through the door. I was a little bit disturbed by the yellow cable running through the front door. Thought it was a health and safety issue.
It might have been last week, the actual anniversary, but it's really, for me, it feels like it's tonight. And I do say hats off to you. And I'd like to ask you, I mean, how it feels to have pulled off this radio station just like that.
Well, it wasn't.
I mean,
it wasn't quite like that.
Well, we're a year later. It rolls. It works.
No,
it works
it is.
From
no,
the beginning.
Absolutely. It was. If I rewind 373 days ago, however long it was, I really thought that we weren't quite going to make it. But somehow we managed to, which was good. And of course, you know, every day it got easier. I think by Christmas time, once we got over the Christmas hump, it was incredibly easy. So. here we are, big party tonight, and I'm sure we'll be talking about it more this evening.
Fantastic. Thank you very much. Can't wait to be out there and party with you. This is all we have time for today, so it's time to thank my producer, Don Trump, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, our studio manager, Ben Jay, and of course, our interns, James Pearson and Henrietta Landels. Don't forget you can hear us live from the Monocle 24 anniversary party, as Tyler just mentioned, straight after this week's newest episode of Section D. In 3 hours' time at 2200 hours here in London, Tamsin Smith and Ted Kravitz will be back for the Monocle Daily. I'll be back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow night. Don't know if Tyler will be with me, but he's with me now.
If you want, I'll be around. That's not a problem.
I can definitely
be around. Definitely. Are you going to talk to time? You've got another 20 seconds to
with
fill.
You here, that should be absolutely easy. They're saying rap, but you're here and it's your station.
I know that they just panic in there, but we've got another 13 seconds, 12 seconds, which is good.
I would love to see you in your tract. My later hosting.
We can do that. Absolutely.
I'm looking forward to that, and I'm thanking you very much for being here with us tonight. Bye-bye.